Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 21st of March, 2012, and today I'm honored to be joined on the line once again by Pepe Escobar, whose writings are featured in the Asia Times Online and BoilingFrogsPost.com and Alternet and many, many other media outlets besides. So Pepe Escobar, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be with you, James.
All right. Well, today I wanted to talk specifically about a paradigm that has been taking shape for at least a decade now, or maybe two decades, but certainly has been coming into focus in the last year or two. And that's the paradigm of the humanitarian war, or the responsibility to protect, so-called. And we've seen this concept, which seems to be coming from a good-intentioned place, being obviously used for nefarious purposes, as we saw tragically in Libya last year, and as we see very much the same rhetoric being deployed with the lead up to possible intervention in Syria. So can you tell us from your own perspective what this paradigm is all about and where it came from?
Yes. R2P became famous all over the world, of course, because of Libya last year. But this is a long story. This is a 10-year-long story. Probably many people don't remember that. So I think it's important to come back to 2001. When the original concept was actually masterminded by this fabulously named International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty. This was actually a panel. It was sponsored by the Canadian government, by the way, with some foundations backing it. And the leader was definitely not a warmonger, was a very good guy. Put it this simply, the former Australian Prime Minister, Gareth Evans. So the idea, the original idea was, I quote them, international community had a moral duty to in terms of humanitarian intervention. So the original idea, of course, was altruistic. They were probably thinking about Rwanda. They were probably thinking about the Congo. They were probably even thinking about the Khmer Rouge in the 70s, right? So, but let's see how this evolved in the long run. In 2004, this original idea was already being debated at the UN. And Kofi Annan established a panel to debate it. And the Security Council was very interested in authorizing, I quote them, the Security Council, military intervention only as a last resort. So they kept the original idea of that international commission that we mentioned a while ago. And very, very important, military intervention, like we saw in Libya last year, only as a last resort. Then we get to 2005, very important, when the UN General Assembly, at the time 191 countries, they endorsed a resolution that would support R2P, but there was no vote about it, okay? Very important, always considering that no military intervention was in the cards. And finally, in 2006, the UN Security Council, only the 15, the five plus the other non-permanent members, they voted a resolution number 1674. And this resolution was basically the core of R2P, involved in protecting civilians in armed conflict and protecting civilians from, I quote them again, genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. So if we look at this timeline, it looks very altruistic, no? And very humanitarian. But the thing is how major foreign powers were going to use this carte blanche from the UN Security Council. This didn't happen in 2007, 2008, 2009, but it happened in 2010, but it happened in 2011. This didn't happen, for instance, in late 2008, early 2009, when Israel invaded Gaza, bombed Gaza, and killed at least documented 1,400 people, including a lot of women and children. Nobody talked about R2P. But last year, with how can I describe Libya? With that mix of forced intervention, indigenous movement, military coup, you name it, fill in the blanks. they saw an opening. And when I say they, I mean especially three of the five permanent members of the Security Council, the US, Britain, and France. We have analyzed extensively, including you, James, in your reports, all the hidden reasons and all the different agendas for intervention in Libya. But in the case of applying R2P, there were three people who were instrumental in regimenting the U.S. support and trying to convince other members that this was the way to go in 2011. I call them the three graces: Hillary Clinton, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Susan Rice, and Special Advisor to President Obama Samantha Power, who was very close to Sergio Vieira de Mello when Sergio was at the U.N. Sergio was the special envoy to Iraq when he was killed in Baghdad in 2003. So these three graces, they organized the media push, the one message for the Obama administration, the talks between the U.S., the Europeans, especially Britain and France, and other members of the Security Council at the time, especially Arab members, and of course the Persian Gulf monarchies. So they sold the world the idea that they would intervene in Libya to prevent a humanitarian massacre that was not documented, and we later discovered was not happening. The notion that major powers like the US or even lesser powers like Britain and France, that they conduct their foreign policy based on humanitarian principles is an absolute joke. And the proof was last year in Libya.
Unfortunately so, and I think you bring out very well the fundamental underlying hypocrisy that this is applied and invoked in situations where it's amenable to the foreign interests of Britain or France or America or Israel or any, you know, fill in the blank, but is obviously not used in situations like in the occupation of Gaza. So I think that's a very blatant hypocrisy that's very evident to a lot of people, but clearly doesn't function at the institutional level. I mean, at what point does that disconnect become so blatant that the vast majority of the people won't go along with this responsibility to protect agenda?
Well, the thing is, the way R2P was manipulated to legitimize the invasion, bombing, and fragmentation of Libya, because this is what's happening nowadays. Look at what Libya is post-NATO intervention. It's a totally failed state run by militias. And nobody cares about what's going on in Libya. Proof number one, it disappeared from the news cycle completely. Proof number two, what only matters to the so-called international community, which, as we know, is comprised of U.S., Britain, France, Tel Aviv, and the Persian Gulf monarchies, and nobody else, maybe Turkey sometimes, no? Or Japan or South Korea. This is the international community. The only thing that mattered for them was the oil, gas, and further on, the water, of course. This is in terms of the three major French water companies. And nobody cares what's going to happen to Libya. Libya is going to be mired in civil war for years and probably decades from now on. But nobody cares. Okay. The thing is, a lot of very important countries at the moment, including the four top BRIC. Now it's BRICS with South Africa, but the four top BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and Germany, they saw how R2P would be instrumentalized to become basically the entry point for an armed intervention, which is condemned by the original idea of R2P itself, as we were talking a while ago, right? So that explains why they abstained from the vote in UN Security Resolution 1973. They got together before the vote. The BRICS were all in favor. South Africa didn't abstain because they got a phone call from Obama. Obama was on the phone with President Zuma for more than an hour and said, look, if you don't vote for us with this, you're going to be in trouble. And Germany as well was aligned with the BRIC in this vote. They knew what would happen later. That's exactly what we all know happened later, right? So it's a major hypocrisy because they knew that this was being instrumentalized at the time by the three Western powers at the UN Security Council. Later they say, look, if you do this with, and at the time, in fact, if you do this with Libya, why don't you do this with Bahrain? Silence. Total silence, right? Why don't you do this with the... In fact, what's going on in Eastern Saudi Arabia nowadays, which is never reported, including in Arab media, which is most of it controlled by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they are killing civilians also in Eastern Saudi Arabia, and we don't know about it. We hear about it by some dissident Arab bloggers here and there, but this is a slow motion process. You could compare it with what was happening in Bahrain, and you could compare it what's happening in many other Arab countries. But there's the only interference is in a secular Arab republic, which is the case of Libya, and was once again invoked in the case of Syria. But now, Russia and China were very much alert to what happened before. They knew that what happened before would happen, so they voted to possible UN Security Council resolutions, which would regiment R2P as an intervention in Syria. So another thing, well, the case of Gaza is so blatant that we don't even need to repeat it, right? Why R2P was not invoked these past few years to prevent what we can describe very accurately, I would say, as a slow motion genocide of the Palestinian population? We all know the answers for that. The U.S. will always veto it. And China was thinking, look, one of these days they're going to use R2P to go against us in terms of what's going on in Tibet and Xinjiang, especially in Tibet. What's been going on in Tibet, maybe it's not a genocide, but civilians are being killed in Tibet on a constant basis, at least since the late 1990s, only to talk about this past 10 years, in order to talk about the span covered by R2P, when they start discussing R2P in 2001. In Xinjiang, it's the same thing. Xinjiang, there are 500,000 Chinese troops basically occupying Xinjiang, which is basically an immense desert with one big city, Urumqi, lots of villages, and the rest is desert, but with lots of oil and gas and very close to Central Asia and close to Russia as well. It's a very strategic area for China. And China simply cannot envision any splittists, as they call it, movement in Xinjiang, right? Russia was saying, look, maybe they could use this against us in terms of Chechnya. In Chechnya, there was, or there has been since the mid to late 80s, a civil war going on that was won by the Russian army at the price of a slow motion genocide as well, by all means. So it depends, of course, on which major foreign power is conducting the framing of R2P. If it's the U.S., Britain, and France, it works because it's for our Western interests, right? But if it's going to be directed against Russia and China, other big powers, they know there's absolutely no chance that this will go on because it will be vetoed at the UN Security Council. So in terms of an international consensus about R2P, there is none whatsoever. Right. So we're going to see R2P being implemented as long as Western powers especially find a window of opportunity to get a vote at the UN. If they don't get a vote at the UN, we're going to see what we are seeing in Syria at this moment, which is Saudi Arabia arming jihadis or Salafis in Syria and betting on a civil war, basically. And now with the help, as a matter of public record, in fact, of the United States.
So let's flesh out that narrative a bit, because it seems like you're painting a picture that in the Libyan example, Russia and China abstained, and they learned their lesson from that. In Syria, they've vetoed the resolutions trying to implement the same policy. So does that indicate that from here on out, we can expect to see Russia and China giving more pushback to this idea?
Yeah, Definitely. Oh, yes, definitely. And the non-aligned countries as well. We cannot forget that 120-plus members of the non-aligned countries. Many of these countries are not exactly Western liberal democracies, as we know. And many fear that R2P could be used against themselves. So the original idea of R2P, of course, it is very altruistic and it is a fabulous idea. But why nobody's thought about that before or during the Rwanda massacre? Why nobody's thought about that, you know, the genocide in Palestine, the slow motion genocide in Palestine has been going on for 50 years. And I can't imagine that nobody at the UN or high-minded politicians such as Gareth Evans in Australia never thought about implementing R2P at the UN Security Council level. So why now, right? Why now? Because now we are watching a total reformulation of that axis from Northern Africa to the Middle East, which is part of what the Pentagon used to call arc of instability. There's a lot of American neocons gleefully call creative destruction going on. So if you can advance a Western agenda in terms of the Mediterranean as a NATO lake, or more pro-Western governments in all these countries, a less unsavory dictatorship, but still defending interests of Western companies and Western governments in that area, why not? So any weapon is available, any weapon is good, including R2P.
Well, absolutely right. So let's change gears slightly, but on that note of any weapon is good for the destabilization of countries that are against Western interests, of course we can look at the demonization of Iran, and of course R2P hasn't been implemented there, but what we have seen is the interesting moves that have been made in recent months by many prominent neocons in Washington to delist the MEK, the Mujahideen-e Khalq Organization, as a terrorist organization on the U.S. State Department list, which is an interesting move for a lot of reasons. I'd like to get your take on the MEK and what role they're playing in Iran right now, and of course the history of that organization.
Well, they're essentially they're a bunch of nutcases. Iranians themselves, they never paid much attention to the MEK. First of all, because they were based in Iraq, right? In Iraq during Saddam. So they knew that their only agenda was to subvert what was going on inside Iran, and even going against the civilian population in Iran. So they never got support in Iran, even from leftists or the formerly exterminated Communist Party that today in Iran, or intellectuals, or later on the Google generation. And in Iraq, they had a sanctuary during Saddam because, of course, they were serving Saddam's agenda of trying to destabilize the Islamic Republic since the beginning of the Islamic Republic in 79. And now, obviously, nowadays, what the neocons, they don't have many instruments to provoke agitation and subversion inside Iran. First of all, because they don't know anybody in Iran. They have no connections. They don't even know how Iranian society, which is very complex, works. So when they see a terrorist organization based in Iraq with a training camp in Iraq that is trying to destabilize the government in Tehran, that's the perfect Western ally, right? So why not? You know, you are a terrorist only if... when you're not our bastard, you are a terrorist. When you become useful to us, you automatically are declassified as terrorist and become our bastard. You know, it's been working like this for decades. Everybody knows that. So the hypocrisy is galactic, I would say.
I think that's a good adjective. Absolutely galactic. Well, there have been reports from the Farsi news, obviously the Iranian state news agencies, that that there have been reports of Mossad operatives and others declaring that that the MEK or the MKO have been used as people to carry out the assassinations that we've seen on Iranian scientists recently. I wonder if you have any other sources on that, or if you think that sort of fits in with the overall narrative.
Very good question, James. According to our sources and the people I'm in touch with in Iran, yes, MEK people are being used by Mossad not only to carry operations inside Iran, but also as false flags around the world. So, you know, for instance, this inconclusive investigation of the attacks, in especially in Delhi and here in Bangkok, nobody knows what really happened. This could be a bunch of disgruntled Iranians with no state support, of course, but it could be a false flag Mossad operation using Iranians that are affiliated with MEK. And the investigations, both in India and here in Thailand, are going nowhere. It's, you know, they're supposition, speculation, but there are no hard facts. So this option is still on the table. In terms of the MEK being an effective means of destabilizing the leadership in Tehran, this is also a joke. There are a bunch of, you know, they are, when they were established in Iraq, there were like 300 to 400 people max. Some of them have military training, not exactly state of the art. And now that they are more or less disbanded and they become a mini diaspora, they are probably, some of them are probably relocated to the Middle East. Some are back in Iran, with an alternate ID, let's put it this way. And some probably came to Asia. To India, it's very easy to go to India or to Thailand, for instance. You get, for these people, for instance, they get a visa at the airport. So it's not like Japan, we were discussing. They don't get fingerprinted or anything, you know. So, but to believe that these people are sufficiently trained and sufficiently skilled to mount large-scale operations against Iranian interests, either inside Iran or in other countries in Asia that have friendly relations with Iran, we might say that's the case of Thailand, and especially that's the case of India that has very good commercial and trade and energy relations with Iran. This is a no-go, absolute no-go.
Well, then I was going to ask what recourse the Iranian government would really have against this organization, given that it's protected at Camp Ashraf in Iraq, and obviously striking out against it would be considered an international act of war worthy of international aggression. But if they're not that much of a threat, I mean, can the Iranian government simply sit back and basically expose how they're being used?
Well, they are. In fact, if you read the Iranian official press, of course, most of it, by the way, is official. This is what they are spinning. These people are being manipulated. They are a terrorist organization. Even the U.S. and Europeans considered them until yesterday a terrorist organization. They are very disorganized, and they are being used by the Mossad to mount false flag operations. So for them, it's okay because they know that it's not exactly a threat. The internal security apparatus in Iran is very, very good. It's very, very hardcore. And in many cases, unfortunately, directed against their own population. And in fact, and of course, directed against foreign threats as well. The assassination of Iranian scientists in Tehran, it's a completely different story because this is not MEK. This is an ultra-skilled operation. And of course, we don't have 100% proof, but it's got to be a Mossad organized operation. There's practically no question about that. Or, of course, it could be even with input from Western security services. But of course, this is speculation. We don't have enough material for that. But this is what the Iranians are really worried about. Or the Stuxnet virus, for instance, which was an Israeli-conducted cyber attack. They worry about these kinds of stuff. They not worry about a bunch of crazies that were in Iraq until yesterday, and now they are trying underwear bomber-style gambits in parts of Asia or even inside Iran. Yeah.
So how do you see this playing out? Do you think they will be delisted in the near future by the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. Of course. If the neocons and parts, I would say it's very important, some sectors or factions of the intelligence community in the U.S. Have their way, they will be declassified, of course. And some people inside the State Department will love it as well. It's an excellent propaganda move for them.
Well, but again, the hypocrisy being so galactic.
It's over and over, and it is cosmic, in fact, because it's repeated over and over and over again.
Unfortunately so. Well, let's stop history repeating and let's inform the masses about what's really happening. So, Pepe Escobar, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, James. Thank you.